Next on The Mole, Joel Clement and his guest discuss electoralism. It's a substitute, really, for participative democracy. And they also discuss what real democracy would look like.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined today with Curtis Hansoni. We're going to be talking about democracy. Curtis is an organizer with Portland Tenants United, but they are also an editor for the web journal called North Star and formerly the Secretary General of the Communist Party USA, the Oregon branch. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole today, Curtis.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Good to be here.
So it's the day before Election Day, and in, I think, Americans' minds, this is the epitome of democracy. We hear about how we are the world's greatest democracy, and that often comes down to this notion of our political institution of the election. And I wanted to have you on today to talk a bit about how that really is a impoverished view of democracy. So let's start off by just kind of, I want to ask you what you think democracy is.
When we talk about democracy, we tend to use a model that our social contract has. And then there's the question of how enacted is that social contract currently? And then there's the further question of, are there ways of living more democratically that aren't contained within our social contract? So I think there's a really good case here in Oregon for saying that even democracy, according to our social contract, has already been suspended. The first example of that would be the Cascade Locks Project, which is Nestle wanting to build a water plant that's going to effectively steal billions of gallons of our glacial meltwater that the region is famous for, and essentially rob us all blind and make a huge profit off of that water while depriving our natural resources. So Cascade Locks as a community held a referendum and overwhelmingly voted against allowing Nestle to come in and build this plant. The city government of Cascade Locks responded by saying, well, we're doing it anyway because we have a contractual agreement with Nestle to allow them to do this. And Kate Brown, the governor of the state, has thrown her support behind the Cascade Locks government and effectively Nestle against the already expressed democratic wishes of the people. So effectively, they're saying the vote of the people is meaningless. And then the other side of that is here in Portland, very infamously and recently, Don't Shoot Portland engaged in several weeks of protest because City Hall was locked down and they were being prevented from testifying against the proposed police union contract. So after 2 weeks of protest that was all nonviolent, they were invited into City Hall to testify. So a bunch of organizers and some of them had kids, are sitting in the lobby with tickets to city council to testify. They're not even making a ruckus. They're just sitting there waiting when they are violently attacked by police and riot gear inside City Hall. They are sprayed with pepper spray. They're attacked with batons. And the police start throwing them down the stairs into the street. Some of these protesters were rendered unconscious. Police were seen head stomping people that were already unconscious. Just a general bloodbath, really attempted murder. It's amazing that no one died that day. So when you put the Cascade Locks picture together with the City Hall bloodbath, we can say that even under our current vision of democracy, democracy in Oregon is suspended.
And I don't want to get us into the weeds too quickly. You know, pulling back that, I think, points to the problems when we approach democracy as something where we're electing representatives versus the direct enactment of community will. And could you speak really briefly to this distinction between representative and direct democracy?
Oh, yes, that's a great distinction to make. We elect leaders who are expected to enact the will of the people, but they effectively function as oligarchs because they're a political class that is moneyed and powered And they live in a different world than we do. They get different privileges than we have access to. And they essentially make deals with those who are able to contribute to their campaigns. And it's a sort of a mutual back-scratching situation where they can do things we don't have access to. And we're socialized to think that we don't have the skills or the understanding to do what they do, which is a situation that's enforced on us. And that's an unsustainable situation. So I think we need to learn to live in community, first of all, and we need to step up our political education to the point to where we can live in direct democracy rather than trusting and outsourcing our democracy.
And there are many examples of democracy enacted directly that I think we can look to. Unions, worker cooperatives, housing cooperatives, the experiments in Rojava, which I know that you have some background with. What are they doing in Rojava that that could support this vision of a more democratic society?
Sure. Big fan of Rojava. And I've been talking to organizers and leaders there for a couple of years now. Rojava, the Syrian part of Kurdistan, the social model and social experiment is based on Murray Bookchin's democratic confederalism. So it's essentially a giant lab for direct democracy. So there is no state in Rojava. The people govern themselves really locally on a town hall sort of level. And then they have basically recorders that liaise with the different town halls, so to speak, for the three cantons that are in Rojava so that everybody knows what the other cantons are doing and what individual towns are doing. And they can kind of stay on the same page and they can coordinate democratically.
But how are they able to actually go about the tasks of democracy? You know, here in the United States, listeners often have to work for 40 hours a week. They have families. There are all these other demands that kind of make it hard to actually be informed and to go to meetings if that's what it really calls for, not to mention the demands for having to pay the rent and things like that.
Well, there are alternative non-capitalist and anti-capitalist ways to live to where, you know, when you don't have a capitalist class that's extracting the surplus value of labor from you, you don't actually need to work 40 hours a week or more, as Americans do overwhelmingly, in order to meet the basic needs of your life. If we live in a society that is based on cooperation and mutual aid rather than a society based on competition and isolation, then there is enough leisure time and there's enough education available that we can function in more democratic ways. We can basically workshop more democratic forms of life that don't prevent us from taking on those tasks that we currently outsource to oligarchs.
So what you're saying is that capitalism prevents democracy?
Yes. I'm saying that you can have capitalism and you can have democracy, but you can't have both. You have to choose.
It reminds me of something I was reading the other day, Albert Einstein's famous essay he wrote for Monthly Review called Why Socialism? And there's this paragraph where he speaks to, I think, this contradiction. He says, private capital tends to become concentrated in few hands, partly because of competition among capitalists and partly because of technological development and the increasing division of labor, which encourages the formation of larger units of production at the expense of smaller ones. The result of these developments is an oligarchy of private capital, the enormous power of which cannot be effectively checked, even by a democratically organized political society. This is true since the members of legislative bodies are selected by political parties, largely financed or otherwise influenced by private capitalists, who for all practical purposes separate the electorate from the legislature. The consequence is that the representatives of the people do not, in fact, sufficiently protect the interests of the underprivileged sections of the population. Moreover, under existing conditions, private capitalists inevitably control directly or indirectly the main sources of information, press, radio, education. It is thus extremely difficult, and indeed in most cases quite impossible, for the individual citizen to come to objective conclusions and to make intelligent use of his political rights. And I think what that gets at is how it's not even that, you know, there's money in democracy, but that the fact that money structures our very way of life itself is in contradiction with democracy as a social ideal. How do you think that we can begin to address that contradiction?
Okay, well, that's one of the first tasks of socialism is the idea of economic democracy, which removes the capitalist class, removes the extraction of surplus value of labor, and laborers keep product of their own labor. But ultimately, in a democratic confederalism, which is a form of anarchism, you move away from that to the point where moneyless society is the ultimate aspiration. So, for instance, in the Kobani canton of Rojava, it's effectively moneyless. So, for instance, I know of an Iraqi Kurdish couple that moved from Iraqi Kurdistan to Rojava, and there was an empty house that they moved into, and they registered their presence in the house and were allowed to move in. No money changed hands. And as long as they're staying in that house, as long as they're using it, then no one will mess with their stuff. No one's coming for their toothbrush. But the reason it works is there's no concept of private property. So there's personal property. You can make that distinction. But it all goes on use and need, which really goes back to the Marxist idea, you know, from each according to ability to each according to need. And when we live in that way, when the needs of our life is available to us without constantly enriching someone else, then we can live in economic democracy, which makes political democracy meaningful. So if you try to do political democracy without economic democracy, you end up with just this surplus value of labor creating a moneyed oligarch class, which uses that value of labor, that money, to enact power, to reshape the world in their will.
I remember Emma Goldman famously saying that if voting changed anything, they would make it illegal. And I think Lucy Parsons, a contemporary of Emma Goldman, also said something similar to that, that the wealthy are not going to let you vote away their wealth, and that the wealthy have power that is not necessarily the power of political democracy. It's the power over society and over our lives, and it's through that power that they're able to actually control the so-called political democracy.
It's easily testable and easily proven, just with the examples in Oregon I cited earlier. So we see that this form of democracy doesn't work because we think we can have capitalism and democracy at the same time, when really there can be only one. So we must choose democracy and learn how to dismantle capitalism so that democracy can flourish. And I think it goes beyond just economic democracy. It goes to living in community. Capitalism isolates us because we are powerless against the state. As long as we live in competition with one another and as long as we live in isolation. So, for instance, how many of you know how much your coworker at the next cubicle makes? You know, what's their salary? You have no idea, right? How many of you know how much your neighbor pays in rent? No idea, right? Because they don't want us to know. They don't want us trading notes as workers. They don't want us banding together and unionizing because it's a threat to them. So they want us all isolated and afraid and feeling powerless. But when the people unite, when the people rise up and throw off their chains, we don't have to live in isolated ways. And so democracy is really just a function of a healthy communal society. So the more we learn to care for our neighbors and to de-isolate ourselves, the more we restore the historical, you know, community connections between people, the more we can break down the system of capitalism and statism and learn to live in more democratic ways organically.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. My name's Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Curtis Hansoni about democracy and the reasons that we need to think beyond this election for our concept of democracy. Thank you for coming on the Old Mole, Curtis.
Very welcome, Joe. Thanks for having me.